Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 8, Episode 120. I am Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com and sitting in for my co-host David Todd on this fine Friday, June 29th. The last Friday in June is Alex Cazora. Alex, happy Friday. We got about, 4 weeks from today, and you'll be sitting in Latrobe.
No place I'd rather be, Dave. And before the show, we were talking about if I play Madden. And I actually don't play a lot of Madden, but I think my Christmas gift to you this year is going to be a PlayStation and a copy of Madden, because we got to get you playing a little bit.
You know, I used to be when I was a kid. You know, we had Pong.
Oh my goodness.
We had Pong, and then. I don't know. It felt like the old man hit the lottery, I guess. We then had an Atari, one of the original Ataris. And I'm assuming you've never had to play or plug in an Atari before, but you know, they came with these game cartridges that you had to insert in and all like that. And believe it or not, I was quite the video gamer when I was. You know, whatever year that was and that came out, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, right around in there. I got pretty good at all those games. But as far as the new Madden and, you know, the newer Madden, in fact, I think Tecmo Bowl was kind of the last, my last trip through video games. I just, you know, with having to actually have a life and work, from 14 on, you don't have time to play video games there. And then, you know, I would like nothing more than probably sit in front of the computer and play games all day, but obviously I can't. Maybe in my final years I'll be able to go back to doing that. But they're so realistic now. You know, I do see these games and the Madden promos and all these, you know, what do they call them, third person or third shooter games or whatever they call them. It's just unbelievable how realistic these things are now.
Yeah, no, they're definitely some great advancements. They're coming out with, I think later this year, a football sim. It's like a hardcore football sim. It's all kind of text-based. You don't really play it in the sense that you play Madden, but I have the baseball version of it. It's a lot of fun. And I think that you would probably quit this job, Dave, when I get it for you, because it's so involved, it's so addicting. So if it comes out, when it comes out, I am seriously buying you a copy of it and probably never saying hi to you again, because it's probably gonna have stuff like exclusive rights and practice squad 90-man rosters. Like, it's gonna be legit, so I think it's gonna be up your alley.
You know, I don't know how, obviously you played Madden and before, does that actually help? You know, players with actually, you know, identifying defenses and offensive schemes and that kind of thing? How much realism is it when it comes to some of that stuff? And can your football IQ actually increase when playing it?
I think it did for me, you know, someone that didn't really play football growing up. I haven't played a copy of Madden in a while, but I had it on the PS2 era kind of in its real heyday, and it helped me learn a lot about the game, and you hear that from a lot of players too. That's kind of how they grew up and how they got some exposure to football. So in a way it does, and from what I know about some of the copies, you know, today, the modern era, I mean, you hear stuff like pattern matching and, you know different kind of coverages and blitz schemes and stuff like that. It sounds pretty advanced. So yeah, I think in a way that it does help.
You know, we're in that time of or era now with the whole virtual reality stuff, and you hear some of these NFL teams. You know, I would like to play something along those lines where you're actually, you know, where you're a quarterback or whatnot, and you're having to, you know, where it depends on quick decision making such as that, where you're looking at it kind of what would that be, first person? Look at it.
Yeah, Yeah, that'd be really cool. The Steelers probably have, I mean, I'm sure every team has something like that. But yeah, the technology is just getting better and better.
Well, you know, Carson, who was it? Carson Palmer has used that stuff before in the NFL. Okay. And I think more and more quarterbacks are starting to use that stuff more and more. I think we've written about it on the site in the past, and yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a thing now, is being able to, you know, being able to train quarterbacks and you know, whatever position, I guess, you know, running backs as well too, by throwing. I mean, look, it's like an airplane simulator, right? I mean, you try to simulate as much stuff in real time as possible, and if players can do it outside, you know, allotted CBA practice times, then why not, you know?
That's a great point.
Have you watched any of these new series of those what are they? I don't know. What are they calling that series on NFL.com? Confidential or
yeah, you have the one with Mike Daniels.
Right, right, boy.
I haven't seen him yet.
Oh,
I heard they're good.
Lord, you and anybody listening to this podcast, start tuning into these things. They are very. I think the series. I'm trying to think if the series started with Joe Thomas. Or with who's the Eagles head coach?
Doug Peterson.
Yeah, Doug Peterson.
Yeah.
They're talking to Joe Thomas, does one on run blocking and pass blocking, and it's phenomenal. And Doug Peterson does one. You want to talk about one that everybody listening to this podcast should really start with, is Doug Peterson talking about RPOs.
Your favorite topic?
Oh Lord, it's especially being two that I've just got. I'm coming off of watching 13 games of Mason Rudolph, one right after the other, in that RPO, you know, offense that they ran there. So, goodness gracious, if you want a great way to spend a Friday afternoon, go find that. Just Google, you know, Doug Peterson RPO, you know, NFL.com, and it should take you right to the video. But the latest one with Mike Daniels from the Packers on how to stop the run. Just absolutely fantastic. He shows you a part early in the video where he took a false step and how to, you know, you kind of identify a false step, and then, you know, how he sheds the blockers. Just absolutely great stuff. Alex, I could watch that stuff in those, you know, those coaches seminar videos. I could sit around all day and watch that stuff alone. And I wish we got more. Why isn't more of that stuff bigger than it is? Is just because the general Joe football fan doesn't care about that end of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very niche market. I mean, you have to be a real hardcore person like you or I to really, you know, take interest in that. I think there's a secrecy of the NFL. People don't like to talk about what they're doing a lot. I think maybe that's changing some. You know, I was going to bring up, and
well, it's hard to hide it now. I mean, there's
right.
So much knowledge outside now that it's not like they're hiding anything.
True. I mean, I don't want to sound like a jaded fan, but, you know, I wish Tomlin would do a weekly X's and O's like Peterson does. That even Bill Belichick does a weekly X's and O's breakdown.
Belichick's is the best.
Right.
Yeah.
But some teams keep it close to the vest, and they feel like they have to hide their secrets. You're right. They're not really hidden because it's all out there, but they just don't want to, I guess, help anyone, help us anyway.
Right. You know, I know Tunch Ilkin, you know, does a good segment on the X's and O's during the season as well, too. And look, we do quite a bit of them on the site as well, too. But there's little things that even we miss, you know, going you recently are because of the Ben Roethlisberger ranking on the NFL Network Top 100. You wrote about the Juju. You know, about that play in the Lions game where they identified, you know, I think I identified a different play because I think I wrote about that and you know, a few weeks after that play, and I think I even had a conversation with you. Said, do you remember? Because there was some sort of reference at that time about how they had saw a similar look earlier in the game. And I think I actually identified a totally different game. I mean, a totally different play that I thought helped them identify what they had saw. But it ends up that was wrong, you know. So, you know, even we get stuff wrong. And you and I know quite a bit about not only X's and O's, but what the Steelers do. So, yeah, it would be nice to have Tomlin, you know. I think a lot of that, he just doesn't want to place blame a lot of times, you know. But you can do these without placing blame, I think.
Yeah, there's a train coming, so I'm going to shut up here. You could talk more.
But you get where I'm going. I mean, I'm trying to think of Belichick's are mostly I think when Belichick breaks them down, it's usually either good. It's good plays. It's usually
it's after a win,
right?
I mean, he doesn't do it after a loss.
And it's usually positive plays.
Sure.
That is either his defense or offense makes. So Tomlin could do this, the same thing. But, you know, when it comes to blown coverages or whatnot and that kind of thing, or you know, Tomlin obviously isn't and hasn't in the past, he isn't going to point fingers like that.
Right. Yeah, no, it's just good to hear straight from the team so there's no guesswork with Tunch or myself, because obviously there's going to be a limit to what we know. I mean, you had Peterson the other day talking about the wham blocks and their adjustment to a wham block based on the alignment of the nose tackle. If he's weak side, they're going to do their wham different than if the nose tackle's strong side. So just really cool stuff like that. I mean, I'll get off my soapbox here, but it'd be nice to see that a little bit more from Tomlin and the Steelers.
All right, I don't even know how it got going down.
it's a way to kill 10 minutes of the show, though.
Yeah, going down this route. Well, it started talking about video games, I think. And
from you, of all people, yeah.
Yeah, going from there. Okay, as far as Steeler news goes right now, obviously not a lot of it. I think somebody asked me the other day on Twitter what's going on with Terrell Edmonds and why hasn't he signed yet. Look, it probably is a little bit of a surprise that he isn't signed by now, but there's still a lot of first rounders out there that are not signed. It more than likely has something to do with offset language in the contract, I'm willing to guess. And you know, in short, that's gonna, you know, it's gonna get done here very soon. And most, I will be absolutely shocked if Terrell Edmonds is not signed by the start of training camp. You know, these things with the sliding and all now just makes it super simple. And where he comes in the first round, down there near the bottom, there's not, you know, usually the cutoff of hard offsets and negotiations where that comes usually happens about, you know, 5, 6, 7 picks ahead of them there. So I'm not sure what the holdup is, but you know, whatever it is, it should come to an end pretty soon there, in case you're worried about why Terrell Edmonds has yet to sign. The other, I guess, kind of big news this week, we've kind of known this has been coming for a little while now, is Jameis Winston. The NFL officially laid down the word on Thursday that Jameis Winston will miss, or has been suspended for the first 3 games of the 2018 season. And as part of that, I guess, you know, agreement there, he's not going to appeal it. So that means that Jameis Winston will miss the Buccaneers' Week 3 home game, a Monday night game at that, against the Steelers. Thoughts?
It's a weird situation. You know, I thought there was really good commentary on Twitter about the NFL, again, kind of making it up as they go along with their policy. This should be a 6-game suspension. I don't understand how it's not, based on their own policy of any sort of incident like this. You know, this should be 6 games. So how is it 3? I really don't understand. So, I mean, from a football perspective, you know, the Steelers will likely get Ryan Fitzpatrick, and that's a good thing, I guess, for Steelers fans. But from a broader standpoint and kind of a league policy standpoint, and why there is so much frustration about the inconsistency of how the league kind of handles these things, you know, Zeke gets, 6 games, and, you know, Winston only gets 3. So I'm just trying to figure this whole thing out.
As we all are, I've always said that it should be like a menu. It should be my wife should be able to come in here. I should be able to tell my wife that so-and-so did so-and-so, and she responds back to me, oh, so he got a 3-game suspension, you know.
Right. He negotiated this. How is he allowed to have negotiating power?
I don't know. You know, we obviously report and talk about things that happen off the field. And that's not one of my favorite things to do. So I don't usually dive too deep down into some of these things. But I do know that they, quote-unquote, kind of negotiated out, you know, a suspension. I don't know. Is it because they're afraid to get locked up, you know, get appeal, you know, in court and this, that, and the other? I don't know. But this is going to be, I think, another big part of the CBA, discussions here in a few more years. I already told my wife that be prepared to, you know, for us to go do some traveling during that summer because, it's going to be a layoff, I think. So, you know, I think all that's going to be – how much power does the commissioner have? Is he going to be the one that sets, you know, sets the – whatever the suspension is? Is it going to be more of a – are they going to have to agree on what gets what, you know, kind of menu, if you will? I don't know. But, look, back in 2010, Ben Roethlisberger was really the first under the player personal conduct policy to be suspended. He got 6 games initially, and then through an appeal process and whatnot, it got trimmed to 4. So that's way back in 2010. And here we are with Jameis Winston just right out of the box gets a 3-game suspension.
Yeah, like I said, there's huge inconsistencies. I'm not the first to point it out. I won't be the last to point it out. But, you know, you have what Brady got, what Josh Brown got, the former Giants kicker who only got 1 game for all the domestic abuse allegations against his ex-wife. You can go down the list of just, again, making it up as they go along. It's so hard to predict. And I'm right with you, Dave. And I feel like this for a couple of years now that there will be a really true and lengthy lockout. Come, I guess it'll be the summer of 2020 or 2021, whatever it is. I mean, you know, heck, the last CBA, they missed the Hall of Fame game. They got pretty close to camp. So, you know, relations have only deteriorated since then and pretty significantly. And with all the issues with the Anthem stuff and Goodell's power and just plain Jane financial, you know, revenue sharing kind of split issues, I'd be really surprised to see this get resolved, you know, quickly.
You know, every year or every time you get close to one of these, you know, players say, well, we're saving our money. We're ready to dig in, blah, blah, blah. And, yeah, they did dig in some last time, but push come to shove, there was no real revenue lost. And the players obviously didn't get everything that they wanted, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, the people with the biggest – holding the biggest bag of money – you know, usually gets the most concessions here, if you will. If they want to, man, I've said this a few times, if they want to really make an impact, they have to force some NFL games to be canceled, you know, or even a full season before they want to get somebody's attention to give in on some of these, whatever ends up being some of the key issues here. Look, I mean, we now you have to add on not only some of the things that are carryover from 2011, now you have the whole social injustice thing and all like that that's going to be a play a big part of this as well. Mm. So, it you know, look, I don't look forward to it. I'm not counting down the days to it. You know, it happens, but I think it's going to happen.
I agree, and I think the union is taking steps, and from their perspective, better steps than last time to prepare for a lengthier lockout. They've done things like they're withholding the licensing money that players get from, you know, Madden and jersey sales and stuff like that. Each player gets a split of that. That money's now, I think, starting this offseason is being held up until a new CBA gets done. So those players, especially, you know, guys that don't make a lot of money, some of the, you know, smaller name guys, can have some extra money, you know, when some negotiations happen. So if this lockout does go into camp, into the start of the regular season, they, you know, they're not going to be broke basically. And that's kind of what made them cave last time because players were really feeling the heat of not having that kind of revenue coming in, and you know, kind of really forced the union's hand to get a deal done. So there's some changes being made on the player side. I think it's going to try to give them some more leverage and some more staying power. And again, I don't want to see it happen, but I don't want to say certain, but I'm really confident that we're going to be looking at some sort of loss of games.
You know, this time of year probably would be a great time to get Joel Corey on, not only to talk maybe a little bit more about, you know, what a Le'Veon Bell contract may or may not look like, or what might ultimately happen with Ben Roethlisberger and his contract situation. But, you know, maybe talking about you know, some of these things related to players and their contracts. You know, let's take for example, Alex, a player that makes the NFL minimum. One of the things that I would like to get with Joe Corey and find out is, you know, how much really does a player who makes, you know, let's say $480,000, which is the minimum a season, how much does a player actually probably see of that in his first year? Because I mean, there's obviously the agents, you know, probably take some of that. Taxes obviously takes a good deal of it. If these players have any kind of help, you know, trainers or any, you know, anything that goes along with that kind of stuff, personal, you know, travel. You know, I'm curious if he has a breakdown of how much. Now, it's still going to be a lot. I mean, don't get me wrong. Sure. Let's say a player that makes $480,000 ends up pocketing $200,000. You know,
I've heard it's about half of what the base salary is, what a player's true take-home pay is.
Right. So let's take $240,000 and then pay somebody a full-time, you know, trainer or something like that, $40,000. So we're at $200,000. I mean, $200,000 a year is nothing to sneeze at, but is $200,000 enough to put yourself through some of the things that NFL players put themselves through?
Right, and yeah, one of the big things is for these young guys that come out that aren't even making the minimum, a junior that declares early and goes undrafted. We know so many guys that have been in that position. They're paying back their agent from all the, you know, combine stuff, pre-draft stuff, having a facility to work at. So those guys, you know, have to pay that off for a couple years. And the other thing is while yes, $200,000 is a ton of money and more than a lot of us make. You know, if you're sitting there,
that would buy you a lot of bagel pizza bites. You would open up your own bagel pizza bite kitchen or restaurant. Fast food bagel pizza bites.
Okay, I'm gonna work on the name a little bit.
Let me just tell you this too. I used to eat a lot of pizza when I was a kid, and I could do so without gaining any weight. So, just a PSA: be careful with all that pizza.
Don't get old.
Right? Your blogging metabolism will slow down soon.
The Steelers need for health insurance. That might not cover that. Exactly. But if you're a player in 2020 and it's the summer, you haven't been paid since December, early January, because you only get paid during the season. So, you know, you haven't gotten paid in 8 months or whatever it is. And for guys on the minimum and guys that, you know, young guys that just aren't good with money, that puts them in probably a really difficult spot. And again, I think that's the reason why the union kind of lost out on the last CBA, because they felt like they had to make a deal right away to get games going, get guys paid again, because they have, you know, so many guys playing on the minimum saying, you know, we need money. We haven't been paid in 8 months. We're broke, or we're losing, you know, our bank account here. So I think that the union has taken a different approach this time around to try to give them some more, like I said, staying power long term. Because you're right. Yeah, while it is a lot of money, it's a very weird situation to be in, to be paid like an NFL player. It doesn't, you know, the way you get paid and your expenses are different than others in other, you know, jobs. So it's something to keep in mind.
All right, enough about that off the field kind of stuff now. But Jameis Winston will miss that game. Ryan Fitzpatrick 0-5 for his career against the Steelers. I think we kind of hit on that podcast or two ago. Barring something unforeseen, you know, we would think he's going to be the guy to start the first three games for them, unless they really, you know, because I don't think they want to turn it over to Ryan Griffin yet. You know, I don't think Ryan can beat out the other Ryan just yet either. So, you know, a little bit. Are you at all worried about that game? I mean, it is, you know, it is in Tampa early in the season. At least it's at night, you know. So I'd be more worried about this game if it was played during the day, because we've seen some Steeler teams go down south in that heat and humidity earlier in the season and not play fantastic, you know.
I mean, I'm worried about every game. I've been conditioned that way as a pretty long time Steelers fan, that these games are never easy. They're rarely blowouts. They're always some sort of panic at some point you're dealing with. So I'm worried about every game, especially in June. That's just how I am.
I hear you. The Steelers have only lost once in Tampa Bay, and I think you have to go back. What did I write the other day? Yesterday, 1998. Was that the last time they lost?
I don't remember.
In Tampa Bay here. Hold on, I'll give you the facts here. The Steelers are 5-1 all time against the Buccaneers in games that were played in Tampa. Not that that means a damn thing, but their last loss in Tampa to the Buccaneers was in 1998. The Steelers last played the Buccaneers in Tampa in 2010. I'm sure you remember that game. They won that game 38-13, and just as I mentioned a little while ago, ironically, that game featured Charlie Batch starting at quarterback for the Steelers in place of a suspended Ben Roethlisberger.
Well, yeah, you know, Fitzpatrick is probably going to be the starter, but if this team gets out to a bad start, because they have a tough schedule. They have, the Eagles, I think, week two.
Saints
week one. They could be 0-2, and maybe they make a change. So, you know, we're not going to see Winston, but I'm not – going to say who we are going to see, because it could be Fitzpatrick, it could be Ryan Griffin.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about some quarterbacks now, and before we get into kind of a positional kind of training camp positional review, I am, as of today and not long after we get off of this podcast, I will post the final contextualization of Mason Rudolph from 2017, his bowl game against, who was it, Virginia Tech. And I have now watched every pass attempt that Mason Rudolph made last season, and in detail at that. So I will have some very colorful, I think, breakdown stats-wise either Saturday or Sunday for everybody that's been patient through this series. I don't know how much you've been able to spend watching some of the plays, Alex. I mean, even though I have each play linked, I realize that it would take time to click on every one of them. But I tell you, I really have a firm understanding now of what Mason Rudolph can and can't do in the passing game. And look, as we've said quite a bit, there's a lot of RPO stuff, but his recognition that comes along with that, I think, is top notch. I think his decision making when it comes to running, what he was asked to do when it comes to identifying and running that offense. See, this is a lot of people don't understand. You know, a certain play will come in, and it obviously with them, a lot of it gets signaled in from the sideline. But even though, you know, a play gets signaled in from the sideline, it could still go three or four different ways depending on what the quarterback read is, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And a lot of people, you know, don't quite get a firm grasp on it. And it goes, and I say that because it goes with the Steelers too. A lot of what any offensive coordinator calls, Ben Roethlisberger has the ability to check a lot to something. And especially at this point in his career. And don't think that he did not have that ability under Todd Haley.
He definitely did. Absolutely.
You know, so, you know, think about that. But back to Mason Rudolph. You want to talk about a kid that is a very aggressive going downfield. He is not afraid to take a deep shot in any situation against any kind of, you know, man or cloud type coverage. He's not afraid, and he is not afraid to go outside. Well, I guess saying outside the numbers is a tad bit different than saying outside the numbers. It's better in college to say outside the hash marks because they're wider.
Right. That fits in with Pittsburgh's mentality well, though.
Right. He is not afraid to go outside the hash marks, deep down the field. And by deep down the field, I'm talking 30 yards or more. Now, his accuracy when it comes to those balls, is that the toughest kind of area of the field to defend in the NFL? Deep, deep out, you know, deep numbers are outside.
I mean, I think it's one of the toughest throws for a quarterback to make, like we talked about last time. So I don't know if that makes it harder to defend or maybe in a way easier to defend, because it is such a tough throw to make because the defender has a lot of time to be able to read and anticipate it. I don't know. It's hard to pick out exactly what's the toughest. They're all the toughest when it comes to the NFL.
Now, a lot of those are go routes that he does, or double moves, or post corner post, you know, that kind of stuff. You don't see a lot of quote unquote like hole shots, okay?
Okay.
So I think, and we all know that's, I mean, Ben loves, you know, that kind of stuff and is good at it. We talked recently about how Matthew Stafford has made a living in his career at that. So I think one of the interesting things when Mason Rudolph, as part of his progression, is he going to be able to make those kind of throws?
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't see a lot of that on tape. Now, I tell you what you see a lot of. Excuse me, and as part of obviously the RPOs, you see a lot of those 10, 12 yard speed outs to either side. Mm-hmm. You obviously see a lot of the screen, the RPO screen, and in fact, talking about Doug Peterson, in that recent, you know, segment on NFL.com, he talks about how usually that bubble slant, you know, that in the RPO is usually one of the first things that they put in installation, and he does a good, you know, job of breaking that down. You know, basically a slant coming from either side with a bubble built in to one side, and then if it's a run, you know, it's an inside zone. You know, so he does a great job breaking that down too. But
and Pittsburgh's done similar too.
Sure,
or Haley,
sure,
at least.
Sure, and you know, where was my train of thought here? Okay, with Rudolph, I, you know, the accuracy is there deep down the field, not so much middle of the field in, say, 15 yards or less. He likes to kind of put a little bit too much mustard on him at times. So probably between the college hash marks, his accuracy needs to improve a little bit. Now, I'm not going to get all into, we talked a little bit about velocity and this. That's one question I would like Randy Feetner asked in the coming weeks if they get a hold of him again. And this is the type of question you and I or David Todd would have asked Randy Feetner this last go around. Because, I mean, let's face it, we don't get a chance during this time of the offseason to hear much from these position coaches. But I wanted a question I would ask Randy Feetner is, how much does he think a quarterback such as Mason Rudolph can improve his arm strength, not only distance, but velocity?
Yeah, I'd love to know.
You know, we heard of quarterbacks being able to do that in the past, right?
Yeah, you can do it. With some mechanical tweaks, you can definitely improve that stuff.
Do you ever think Peyton Manning was a quarterback that had huge arm strength or velocity?
Certainly not one of the top things you remember about Peyton Manning. So it may be, maybe not, but I think the whole football IQ and command of the offense was probably the thing you remember most about Peyton Manning.
How much do you think, how much can football IQ and understanding help offset some of that stuff? I mean, he's a great example of that, right, Peyton Manning?
Yeah, yeah, and again, it all helps that if you can anticipate where the defense is doing, and you can get that ball out quicker before the hole closes, you can, you know, go to where the defense isn't. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's immense. You have to have a great football IQ regardless of your physical traits, but you can make up for it if you don't have the great physical traits with a good football IQ.
You know, some of the narratives going around from Steeler fans with Mason Rudolph is he can't move outside the pocket. How many times do you want your quarterback outside the pocket on the move? I mean, look, we saw Ben Roethlisberger early in his career made a lot of signature plays of moving outside the pocket, and he still occasionally does do that. Mason Rudolph is adequate in my opinion, at doing that. I don't think he throws on the move as good as say a Roethlisberger did coming out of college, or as good as, I don't know, what's a good recent example of a kid that throws, a quarterback that's now in the NFL that threw on the move well coming out of college. You got any?
Like a Cam Newton or?
I don't know, Mahomes. Do you think
Mahomes? Yeah, Mahomes would be a good one. Be a great one.
That move pretty. He's not the kind of good guy that I think that if he doesn't, isn't able to plant and throw, and use all arm, I would kind of worry about there. But he can look. He is great. I think he's great at sensing and feeling pressure and avoiding pressure and getting out and making a play. I posted a clip on YouTube yesterday, and I think you're going to see this in this game against Virginia Tech that I'm going to post today, of him getting outside of pocket and threading the needle just past the chains to James Washington along the sideline. So he can do that. I'm not worried about that aspect of the game. So if I had to say my biggest fear right now when it comes to Rudolph would be just overall arm strength, because I think the longest throw was right at 50 or just shortly, 50, 55 or something like that. It was a Hail Mary pass at that. And maybe just some of the velocity, issues there. But outside of that, I mean, the guy, I you watch all these games, and it kind of makes you wonder why this kid was a why this kid ended up being a third round pick.
So I just want to go back to the mobility. I know you just touched on it, but do you believe that that's going to be an issue? It doesn't sound like you believe that it will be, but that was kind of the two biggest knocks on Rudolph coming out was a lack of arm strength in terms of pushing the ball down the field that would float, and just kind of a statue in the pocket, lack of mobility. Do you think that the latter, the lack of mobility, is going to be an issue? Do you think he can manage it?
I don't know. I don't think he's a statue, no.
Okay.
Because he's got some great escapes on tape, and that's just from last year alone. So I mean, I hate to use the Ben Roethlisberger because anybody that escapes pressure with someone pulling on him is now Ben Roethlisberger. Okay,
right.
But he's got some of that on tape. So
okay.
My only thing is some of those. Look, we've seen Ben get out, especially to his right, and be able to throw off of one leg and still heave it 55 yards down the field.
And you don't think Rudolph can do
that
exactly?
I haven't seen it.
Okay, that's fair.
Now, can he do that? The sad thing is right now, and I'm going to get into another segment, and for those of you who we've already lost on this podcast, there's not a lot to talk to talk about today, so that's why we're having to talk about a lot of this this kind of stuff. I wanted some means of comparison, as obviously we don't have Miami of Ohio Ben Roethlisberger tape. There's only like one or two of those games floating around, and I think they're all 22, and I think they're hard to break down. I might try to do that as a kind of comparison. But I went back to 2012. I was thinking to myself, look, I kind of remember liking Landry Jones some coming out of Oklahoma, and I remember they ran a lot of that spread RPO stuff, I remember he had some fairly decent receivers there at Oklahoma. So why not? Let's contextualize a few of these games, just like we've been doing with Mason Rudolph, because I want to just see, because I think it's a good comparison. Look, both these guys come out of 12, that conference there, similar offense, this, that, and the other. Really, the differences are quite staggering, in my opinion. There's some similarities, but there are also you can really pick out a lot of stuff here. Now, look, I've only contextualized two of those games from Landry Jones. Landry was not a quarterback in college that I remember and have gotten through two of the games so far that liked to take those deep shots outside the numbers. So that's one huge difference there. He wasn't all that. He was probably better. He wasn't all that in a bag of chips on the move outside the pocket. But I think coming out, he was a better quarterback on the move than Rudolph is. Do you remember that as being that, or has it been too many days gone?
Yeah, it's probably been too long. You're definitely more qualified to talk about that than I am, reviewing him like you are.
Now, he, I think, threw a better deep middle-of-the-field ball. And, in fact, you know, I posted it this morning on Twitter. That game in 2012 against Kansas, that shot down the middle of the field to Kenny Stills, that ball, I think, flew 50 yards in the air, 50, 55 mm-hmm. yards in the air. I mean, that, I don't know if that was his best deep throw during his career at Oklahoma, but if it wouldn't surprise me if it was, because that thing was money. His deep ball just seems better down the middle of the field than because Rudolph does kind of float his a little bit. Now, as far as accuracy in the middle of the field goes, and out, you know, outside the numbers and all like that, I would, you know, I think Rudolph might have been a little bit more accurate, to be quite honest with you. Now, as far as arm strength goes and all like that, let me get a couple more games into it and all. But I invite everybody listening to watch. You know, I'm going to try to do one more game from 2012, the bowl game of his. Who did they play that year? Oklahoma versus, I don't remember who it was. It was somebody in the Cotton Bowl. But I'm going to break down one more of his, and then I invite everybody to look at that and kind of compare that to some of the tape of Mason Rudolph. I guess what I'm trying to say here is I'm still bullish on Mason Rudolph.
And that's fine. That's totally fine. Let me ask you the last question I have on your Mason Rudolph study. What is the number one thing you learned the most, positive or negative, about Mason Rudolph going through every single one of his passes? Something you didn't know about him until you started the study.
Yikes.
I mean, was it the arm strength, the more mobility than you expected, some of the accuracy, something else, the offense he played in?
I guess just his I would say probably a positive being his aggressiveness and his accuracy outside the numbers, deep.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
He was not afraid. He was not afraid to toss it up 43.4 yards down the sideline. I think that's the thing there.
That, like I said, that fits in, you know, perfectly with the mentality of this offense.
I think one thing he doesn't get enough credit for is his ability to read the field. And go second, third option. You know, mm-hmm. I think he does a good job of that. I'm trying to think of a negative. I wrote this on Twitter yesterday. I think I became an OSU fan.
I think you're going to run the Gruden QB camp now that you're breaking down every play.
Lord have mercy. That was an exciting team to watch. I guess I didn't realize just how fast they went all the time. Look, he was never under center.
I was going to ask that. Was he ever, never, not even goal line?
No, he was never under center. Unless it was a kneel down or something along those lines, or a spike or something like that, he was never under center. So that's going to be a culture shock for him. He ran a lot more pistol than what I thought. And my only regret now in going back through and charting some of these things is I did not chart shotgun versus pistol.
They wouldn't have told you a whole lot anyway.
Right, I don't think it would have. I'll tell you something. He did, a better job of selling play action on these RPOs than you see a lot of quarterbacks that run it do.
That's a good one. Now, he'll have to learn how to run play action from under center. That'll be another element of it. He'll have to adjust.
Right, right. But I think
because it's different. It's different when you're in shotgun when your back's never turned, as opposed to under center when your back's turned.
Right. I think he did a good job of that in there. And look, I mean that. Yeah. I don't care what you run. If you do a good, and you know, one thing, and I hope we see this out, and this is probably a good time to start transitioning into our other topic here. I hope we see more. I want to see more of Ben using play action, even if it is just the empty hand, you know, because he's been so damn good at it throughout his career at using it. You know,
I think the Steelers ran play action the least of anyone in the NFL last season.
So there you go. I mean, does he not like using it? Is it lazy? I don't know.
I think one issue was that I know everyone's running out of shotgun now, but the Steelers especially ran out of shotgun maybe more than anyone else in the league last year, and so they just didn't run under center very often.
But why not when you're not having your back turned? Why not use it more, like Mason did?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know if that was a Ben thing, a Haley thing. I think they didn't use it under center because Ben's losing some mobility, and it's a little bit tougher for him to kind of get away than it was in the past. Now, why they didn't do it out of shotgun, maybe they just felt it wasn't as effective. Maybe they just, you know, for some other reason. I mean, I think we will see more play action. I think we should have seen it more last year. I think we will see it more with Feener this year.
One thing I noticed when watching some of the Landry Jones stuff from 2012 is, you know, a similar kind of offense, but there wasn't that much play action used in it. I mean, don't get me wrong, he used some of it, but I think that's just one of the things that stuck out to me about Mason and watching all this tape is that he would use play action quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
He also, you know what he also likes to do? He also likes to do that kind of that shoulder cock, you know, that fake shoulder, that shoulder fake, you know, pump, if you will. Now you never see him give a good pump fake. I don't know if that's something maybe worth talking about or something, but he would do that kind of that quarter turn. I'm gonna throw it, you know, kind of action there. So I did pick up a little bit on that. Very vocal at times at the line of scrimmage. I have no issue. I don't think obviously he didn't run a huddle. Okay, that's gonna be. But I don't view that's gonna be an issue. And I just viewed him as an incredibly smart. Now that I painted him all this, you know, being bullish on him. How's he going to turn out? I don't know. I mean, we've seen some good quarterbacks come out of college before, you know, first round guys that just ended up not making it. So I don't know what way it's going to go with him, but I've liked almost everything I've seen out of him.
Yeah, no, that's a great detailed explanation and kind of breakdown of them. So thank you for going through all that painstaking. Like you said, at least it was fun to watch. At least this wasn't like Wisconsin, and you're just going through trap blocks for 90 minutes each night. I think you said two interesting things. I think the shoulder fake, you know, Ben was obviously known for his pump fake a little less in recent years, but sometimes that shoulder fake is all you need, because if you're a defender in zone coverage, you're reading that front shoulder. You're not always able to see the football. You're just reading once that shoulder dips, that tells you as a DB that the ball is coming out. But a pump fake could be just as effective with the shoulder fake than with a true pump fake with the football. You bring the football up and bring it back down. So that could be just as effective. And I think the other interesting thing you said, Dave, was at the beginning of our conversation where you said that, you know, Rudolph occasionally just didn't take enough off the football, where some of his passes over the middle were just coming out a little too hot. And I remember that Ben, either Ben said it or Rudolph said it real early in OTAs. That was one of the things that Ben said to Rudolph, was that, you know, you don't have to have your fastball in every single throw. You can take a couple of these off a little bit, let your receiver make the catch. So something else to keep in mind that a lot of rookie quarterbacks kind of struggle with early on.
Yeah, you see him go a little bit high on some things. He was either high, too high, kind of low, real low, skipping it at times. Now, that far hash, 12-yard out, you know, not seeing, not measuring. it's not something that I've sat here and studied with several quarterbacks over the years, and perhaps I should. You know, we just don't have time to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like on TV, angle with Mahomes throwing the far hash 12 yard out? You know, can you notice the velocity difference at time? I'm not qualified enough to comment on that kind of thing, but that's the kind of pass that you got to make in the NFL, right? The opposite side, quick out. And if you float that ball any in the NFL, it's going six the other way.
Or if you're late with it.
Exactly. Yep. Okay, that's a good point there. All right, let's transition a little bit here. We just talked a little bit about Ben Roethlisberger there. And one of the things with him is, and how was I going to transition into this? The ranking? What was on?
The MVP.
The odds on the MVP. 25 to 1 right now. And a year ago, I think it was 12 to 1. Look, odds are odds. And I know that the last thing you like to talk about is odds. You're not a big gambler and all like that. But some of these quarterbacks listed ahead of him, Jared Goff and Deshaun Watson and who else? I mean,
well, Ben was the fourth overall or the fourth quarterback in odds.
No. He was. You're thinking of a different list there. He was like tied for 13th lowest odds.
Oh wow.
And with all quarterbacks, you know, there were Rodgers, Brady, I think Ryan. Goff, Breeze, I think even Phillip Rivers. There's like 12 or 13.
Oh, okay.
12 or 13 quarterbacks that had better odds to win Wentz, better odds to win MVP than Ben Roethlisberger.
Jimmy Garoppolo. Did David Carr make this list? Jimmy Garoppolo has better odds to win MVP than Ben.
Where's Carr on that list?
Derek Carr is right behind Ben. 28 to 1, I guess, the odds.
28 to 1 for him.
Yeah, and Ben's 25 to 1.
And Ben's 25 to 1. Is that worth throwing $100 down on?
It wouldn't be. I'm not a gambler, but it wouldn't be a bad investment to make.
I mean, what legitimately? You know, I understand why Aaron Rodgers has the lowest odds. I mean, Rodgers, Brady, and Wentz are 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, it becomes a crapshoot, right?
Yeah, those are the three guys you could kind of really feel like they're going to be front runners. The rest, Breeze, you could argue, but you could still get the numbers. I'm surprised. Yeah, to see Goff ahead, to see Garoppolo, Kirk Cousins, Phillip Rivers, Carr right behind Ben. I'm cool with Deshaun Watson being ahead. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, but surprised that Ben is a little bit lower.
Is it Watson just because of his ability with his feet or what? I mean,
yeah, and they just had a great year last year. I think, again, kind of like Wentz a little bit, we kind of forget about how dominant Watson was the first 6 weeks before he went down with his torn ACL. He was dynamic on a team that wasn't particularly good. So Tim coming year two is going to be even better, I think.
Yeah, I think that might be worth a C note. Look, I mean, we haven't seen a Steeler win the league MVP since Bradshaw in 78. It's rare for a running back or a wide receiver to win the award. So it's going to be a quarterback. Roethlisberger has enough weapons. I mean, this is where we get into the segment here. This is our, I guess we should formally announce, this is our training camp preview positional breakdown portion of the podcast.
Unless we were formal about it. We're always formal about it, aren't we, Dave?
This is the sloppiest put together podcast probably. For someone who's done it as long as I have, it's still sloppy, but hopefully it's still effective. All right, you know, let's talk a little bit about Roethlisberger and what you're expecting out of him this year.
I mean, in terms of kind of preseason and camp, kind of where I put my initial focus, you know, Ben's Ben. I think he'll get a good chunk of off days. He's Ben. I mean, there's really not much to to learn or explore. I'm just curious to see kind of the subtle changes in Randy Feetner's offense and some of the route concepts and, you know, just some of the different things they do with Ben. And I'm curious to see if they run more pistol. I've talked about that for a while now, that I think that under Feetner that they're going to run more pistol, that Haley didn't like to do it, that Feetner, I think, does, that Munchak wants it, and Feetner and Munchak are pretty tight. So I think that's a good blend to get some more play action while keeping Ben away from being under center. So I guess I'm less interested in Ben himself, but just kind of how he fits into the new offense, which I think obviously he'll fit just fine.
And it's not really a new offense, but
right, yeah.
But what would you suppose Ben would like to do more of outside of just calling
I was gonna say just throw the ball and calling his plays.
calling everything himself.
Turning the mic off.
Realistically, what would you think that Roethlisberger goes into his media, his pregame kind of game planning sessions with Randy Feetner? What would you suppose he's pushing for? Now, obviously, it depends. You know who you're playing.
Sure.
You know, odd, even, front, blah, blah, blah. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't really give you a good answer of anything real specific. I'm going to go a little bit more vague in general and just say he wants to call the plays he's most comfortable with. I think maybe that was one issue with Haley, was that Haley would sometimes call things that Ben probably didn't like as much as other stuff. So I think with Feetner, you know, Feetner knows exactly what Ben wants, and he's probably going to let Ben, you know, when they do, like, you know, red zone plays and third down plays, what's going to be our third and long install? What plays are you going to choose from on third and seven plus? Or what are we going to do in red zone and red zone fringe? You know, that's going to be whatever Ben wants, basically, to a team. There won't be a play in the playbook that Ben doesn't love to run, you know. So I think that's going to be just the biggest thing globally, is that Ben really gets to have his own playbook.
On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being Peyton Manning, where's Ben Roethlisberger's football IQ and game preparation rank?
Well, I think it's always been a bit underrated, and I think that it's been recognized in recent years. You know, Ben's always been viewed as this sandlot, backyard, make it up as you go along quarterback. And, of course, there's been times where it's true, and in Ben's true heyday, you know, 5 years ago, I mean, it happened a lot. But it kind of took away from some of the plays within the pocket that Ben makes. And today, Ben makes significantly more plays within the pocket than he does outside of it. So he's not Peyton, he's not even Tom Brady and some of those guys you really remember him for, but I think it's strong. You see some of the plays he makes, and again, he's running a good chunk of this offense on his own. So, you know, again, our numbers are arbitrary, but, you know, an 8, I think, is a good way to put it.
Oh, really? And I thought you were going to weasel out without giving me a number. I was going to call you David Todd.
Oh, I gave you a number. What would you put it?
Yes.
Oh, you're weaseling out. You're David Todd to me here.
7.
7. Oh, appropriate.
Yeah, I'll take the under.
Take the under.
But there are times I wonder if he was prepared for a certain look, you know, kind of thing.
I don't know if it's that. I just feel like he's got that Favre gunslinger mentality of, yeah, you're showing me this look, but I'm going to beat it anyway.
Right, so right.
I think that's some of the issue he runs into, less than not being prepared for it.
Right. There are sometimes, though, I think in his mind he thinks he sees something. In reality, he sees something else.
Yeah. I gave him an 8. I didn't give him a 10.
Is red zone with him still the biggest issue, and has it been the issue for most of his career?
I mean, it's the biggest issue for the offense as a whole.
Sure, and it has been since whatever, right?
Oh, yeah. Only once since Tomlin got here, the Steelers have had a top 10 red zone offense. I know Matthew Markey and I have gotten into big debates about numbers and semantics and rankings and how much are they really matter and how do you value them. But and obviously red zone offense is going to be a large part with Ben, but it's not just Ben. And I don't have a good answer for why this red zone offense is so underwhelming year in and year out. I wish I had a good answer. Maybe it's something I should look more into. But for Ben and, you know, for Feetner, it's the number one thing. Fix the red zone offense. Stop making it awful. And if he can do that, you know, he'll probably be a successful offensive coordinator.
You know, that just is reminding me too. You want to talk about something that I am really worried about with Mason Rudolph? Red zone.
You thought he struggled in the red zone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not going to get easier. Well,
no, it's not. Those windows are going to get smaller. The reads have got to come a little bit quicker. I think this might – I'm hoping it bears out in the stats that I'm putting together of him on that. But if you really want one area of concern where I'm concerned about Mason Rudolph, it's I think it's red zone. So I'm glad you asked me about that. I'm glad we got to this conversation about Ben, because I think – and look, you could probably say this about a lot of quarterbacks, not only in the NFL, I mean college level and whatever. The smaller the field gets in those areas, now, you know, Tom Brady's awesome in that area. I think really sometimes we'll see if this is where an area where Randy Feitner, you want to talk about noticeable differences with an offensive coordinator. If Randy wants to make his mark instantly this year, it's going to be in the red zone, I think.
I agree 100%, 100%, Dave.
You know, if you want to talk about something 4 or 5 games into the season where we're going to say, where you and I are going to be able to say, you know where the most noticeable difference is with Randy Feitner, we're going to be able to sound smart here, it's going to be red zone. And you would agree with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because this offense is going to move the football regardless of who the offense coordinator is. It's about finishing these drives that they've struggled with under Haley, under Arians for 11 years now, and it's got to change.
And you really want to impress me, it's not only the play calling when it comes to the run in those areas, but how can you mix run and pass and make pass look like run and make run look like pass in those short areas of the field? And if Ben Roethlisberger has his best year ever inside the red zone as a passer, then you're gonna have a lot of hats to take off and hand to people.
Yeah, so that's a really good point about Rudolph, though. I think red zone play is the best way you can evaluate some of these college quarterbacks because it's the closest thing to the NFL. Like you said, windows kind of are tighter and you can't expand the field vertically and open everything else up. So that does give me a little bit of concern, but you know, we'll see what Rudolph does in the preseason.
What are we looking at production-wise for Roethlisberger? What's expected out of him? You know, we're calling this a training camp preview or whatever, but we already had a long talk about what do we expect him, you know, amount of snaps we expect him to play, yada, yada. But what is the expectations for Roethlisberger in 2018? And are those expectations going to put him in the MVP race?
I mean, in terms of just pure numbers, you're looking at similar to last year, you know, 4,300 yards and 30 touchdowns. He's got to cut down on the interceptions. So if you can get a 4,300 yard, 30 touchdown, 10 interception season, probably not going to get you an MVP, but it'll make me a happy Alex.
What now? What does his numbers need to be MVP?
Probably like 4,700 and 35 touchdowns, maybe getting close to 40 with, you know, around 10 picks. That's probably my guess.
If James Washington can come in and impact this offense quickly as far as a deep threat and legitimate out-of-the-box number three wide receiver, and that means running these slants and these 12-yard outs, something that Martavis Bryant never was able to do.
Mm-hmm.
If he can become that player and then everything stays the same, I mean, there's no reason to think he can't throw for 4,800 to 5,000 yards and put up those and have a few more deep pass touchdowns, big play touchdowns.
Yeah, he could. It's just they're going to run it, you know, more than New England and probably Green Bay, because obviously you have Elbel back there. So that just kind of limits him a little bit, I think, in terms of reaching that statistical, you know, mountain.
The Cleveland Browns kick off to the Pittsburgh Steelers to start the 2018 season. It's a touchback, first and 10 from the, 25?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going 11 personnel. I'm going play action, James Washington down right side of the field, outside the numbers. That's what I'm doing.
You heard it here first.
I'm calling my shot right now. why would you not want to do that?
No, I love it, and I bet Ben would love to take that shot and be aggressive. I do it out of like 12 personnel, though. I'd go tight, give them look like they're gonna run.
Okay, well, I'm fine with that as well too. But what hell of a message would that send? I'm putting my rookie wide receiver out there by himself, and I'm running. You know, I'm going deep to him outside the numbers. First play offensive play of the season.
Yeah, they did that on the first game, but what against Chicago last year? I think first play of the game was that deep ball to Bryant that he dropped. That should have been six. They've opened up games like that before.
James Washington, a better wide receiver. Well, we'll save that. Yeah. We'll save that. The other quarterbacks. I mean, we've had a long discussion about Mason Rudolph. I mean, is there any reason to kind of talk about what you know a training camp preview with him? We've already talked a lot about what we want to see him work on, right?
Yeah, I mean, with him, it's just about making smart decisions, snap in, snap out, and learning from mistakes. Mistakes will happen, but it's about not making them twice. I mean, I've always heard, you know, a good way to phrase a quarterback is to make a profit every snap. That doesn't have to mean that you're throwing touchdowns or 50-yard bombs every single snap, but you're just taking care of the football. You know, you're checking it down when you have to. You're throwing it away when you have to. You're not forcing it. You know, your quarterback or center quarterback exchange is clean. Handoffs are clean. You've got command of the huddle. You're getting in and out. You're not getting late. You're getting guys lined up correctly. You're correcting other guys. So, I mean, it's just about making a profit every snap, doing the right thing. And if he does that, you know, he'll be in a much better place than Landry Jones was his first camp and probably a better place than Josh Dobbs was his first camp.
All right, speaking of Landry Jones, what's the best way to summarize him going into this training camp?
Have a seat. Have a seat, Landry.
Or previewing him.
You're going to be on the bench a good bit. And obviously he's going to open camp as a number two, and we know the potential for the debate of Rudolph pushing him. But, you know, he's going to open camp as a number two, so there's no doubt in my mind about that. But we've seen what we've had to see from Landry Jones. I mean, there's really, at this point, he is what he is. He's a career backup. That's not a bad thing, but that's what he is. And he's improved a lot from where he started his career, and you give a lot of credit to him. Football IQ, his ability to prepare, again, the command and confidence he has in the huddle are all positive things in his corner, but, you know, he is what he is.
God forbid, do they have enough offensive weapons, and is Landry Jones a good enough quarterback for this team to win 10 games, 11 games, should something happen?
Where, like, Ben it goes down week one, is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, week one, week two, or whatever. Yeah, early. Too early.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, you know, Jones, the scouting report on Jones is he's got a good arm, a very live arm. He's strong on downfield throws outside the numbers, but on short intermediate throws, on crossing routes over the middle, his accuracy is really poor. And so he fits this offense well in the sense that he can take some of those downfield shots, but you don't get that consistency with, I think, his short and medium accuracy between the numbers that's going to allow him to be successful long term.
So talent, you know, extreme talent on the offensive side of the ball would not be enough to overcome the quarterback?
Not to 10 or 11 wins, no.
You don't think
I think so? 9 might be your ceiling in a wild card spot.
Huh, okay.
We know how quarterbacks are. You know, you look at Deshaun Watson. Texans get off to a great start. He goes down, they bring in Tom Savage. Whole thing tanks. I think Landry's better than Tom Savage, but you get my point.
Right, and we've gotten into this whole where's Landry Jones rank in the backup realm and this. I think he's better than a lot of folks give him credit for, to be honest with you, and I would have never said that 3 years ago.
I agree.
You know, I think he can win some games. I don't want to find out. Joshua Dobbs. He's just got to lay it all out there, right? I mean, and he obviously needs some help. He needs more help from Mason Rudolph than he does. He needs Mason Rudolph to be better than Landry Jones needs to be bad, right?
I'm trying to follow that sentence. I think I understand it. He just needs to focus on himself, though, and just do his thing and, you know, whatever you – everything else, you know, you just can't control. I'm trying to think with Dobbs what exactly I want to see him work on.
Should I contextualize a few of his games here in the next couple weeks or –
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, if you're doing it for Landry Jones in 2012, might as well do it with some stuff with Rudolph, with Dobbs. Dobbs had a good preseason last year. He had a surprisingly good camp. I thought he, you know, for a rookie to come in, not get a ton of reps, Although, you know, with Landry getting hurt, they gave him more chances. I thought Dobbs had a pretty solid first year.
I don't think until that last kind of drive, I don't think he came alive until that Panthers game where he started to feel. We don't know how much is it the talent. He was playing with some bobos there for a little bit, right?
Yeah, your favorite word.
You know, some furniture movers, even at the wide receiver position. It's funny how by the start of the preseason we're saying, well, I'm excited to see this wide receiver, this third string wide receiver group, until we actually get the third string wide receiver group out there. And you're like, does anybody know what the hell's going on out here? They all become bobos by then. But, I mean, legitimately, he should have a decent preseason this year, late in games, right?
He should. I'm going through my training camp recap. Last year I wrote on Dobbs. I think we got to a preseason game or two. He had an awful game against the Giants his first game. But I'm just trying to see what I wrote here. I said live arm with really good placement downfield on anything vertical. It's usually on the correct shoulder. As camp went on, he did a better job of going through his progressions and finding tertiary reads. The volume of snaps was unexpected. Not many bots, center QB exchanges, really nothing wrong on handoffs. I think the biggest thing I have on Dobbs is just, and I don't want to get so focused on the numbers because they're just numbers in camp practices, but his completion percentage in camp last year was 57%, which was the worst I've ever scored on any quarterback I've done for the last like 4 years. So just seeing some consistency on the short intermediate stuff, just again, you know, not making that one bad throw practice, I think it's kind of the stuff for him.
Bro, I can't wait for you to start posting those notes and nuggets from training camp related to that. That's going to be we're almost there, Alex. 4 more weeks. All right, anything to kind of add to this quarterback preview position discussion?
I think it's a really strong group top to bottom, and I think you're going to get some really quality play that's going to help kind of make up for some of the lack of talent that's going to be around them. So the expectations are high for all these guys.
I think so. I think it's the best slew of four quarterbacks. That I can ever remember having in Pittsburgh. So, like I said, I think this is a 4-0. I'll be disappointed if Steelers don't go 4-0 during the preseason just for the sheer fact that I think that they'll have decent quality, decent quarterback play throughout the game. And I think that can help you in quote-unquote preseason games and wins. But we'll definitely see. I'm excited to see how some of this stuff shakes out. Excited to see Mason Rudolph play during the preseason. Excited to see Joshua Dobbs play during the preseason as well, too. I hope our snap predictions come true and what we said, you know, a few episodes ago about playing time with these guys. We know who Roethlisberger is. We know who Landry Jones is at this point. Give us some Rudolph and some Dobbs and let us have a little bit of fun with that and see if these guys have anything to them, moving forward here. All right, heard the train coming. I guess it's time to turn. That means it's been an hour, I guess. So actually a little bit more than an hour. We'll talk a little bit more next week. I don't know if David Todd will be back with me on Tuesday or not. If not, Alex will join me. We're going to continue some of these positional breakdowns and whatever news and notes pops up in between there. You can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow Alex Kozora on Twitter at Alex_Kozora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. You can email the show. Let me know what you think about the breakdowns of Mason. If you've been following along with these Mason Rudolph contextualization posts, you know, over the course of them, say you watched, 25% of them. Let me know your thoughts. Email me your thoughts on Mason Rudolph after watching that versus maybe what you thought about Rudolph coming out of the draft or whatnot. Email me those thoughts at theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you're descriptive enough, we'll read them. Alex and I will read them in an upcoming podcast and discuss them. So help us out there, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and you want to donate to the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com, hit that donate button, up right navigational bar. And as always, thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.